in a standard way with an operator on the vacuum. Okay? Remember that we had this picture of going from the cylinder to the complex plane. And we were mapping in states at the origin. And out states at infinity or at the north pole of the Riemann sphere. The next thing that we did was define a notion of conjugation so that we can go from a bra to a ket. And this gave us the rule for how to take the Hermitian conjugate of any operator in the CFT. And it was something like that. Okay. And what else did it say? Yeah, so then the other thing that we did is we found it convenient when we're in the complex plane to do the same thing that we do in usually in flat space, which is to decompose our operators into kind of creation and annihilation operators by doing a Lorentz expansion of the operator. That, where H, again, is the L naught eigenvalue. Okay. Remember that, and this goes back to some lectures before, but let me just say it again, that from this point of view, the Hamiltonian in this picture, which is moving you up the cylinder, the Hamiltonian of the cylinder is essentially the same as L naught plus L naught bar, which is the operator of the scaling dimensions. So that's why in the plane we're computing the spectrum of this particular operator, because it's the same as the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in this in the cylinder picture. And H is just the L naught eigenvalue. Everything I say has a anti-holomorphic piece, but just sort of factorizes that. So I don't write the analog formula for the anti-holomorphic part of the operator, but it's essentially the same formula with some bars everywhere. And what we saw is that this rule told us that under Hermitian conjugation, the Hermitian conjugation acts very simply on the Fourier modes of the operator. Okay? So we use this to, in particular, study a little bit the vacuum. And what we did is we demand regularity at the origin of the complex plane of the of this object by saying that the stress tensor near the origin acting on the in vacuum has to be regular. And this gave us the condition that LM, so remember that we defined LM, these are sometimes known as the Virasoro generators. Like that, right? And from here we concluded that in order for this to not blow up at the origin, we needed to impose that the vacuum is annihilated by all Fourier modes with quantum number bigger than minus one. Then by doing the Hermitian conjugate, we found the analog statement, where here, okay, this is L minus M, and this has to be equal to also M minus 1. So that means that, okay, first of all, this condition could have also been derived. So here I derived it by just taking dagger, right, and using the fact that dagger acts on the mode like this. But I could also have derived it, if you wanted to, from demanding regularity of this object at infinity. And you can do a simple exercise to show that if you study this condition, you'll recover exactly this. Okay. And essentially the way of doing it is to study infinity by doing a transformation. So let me use a hint. You can derive this in this way by doing this conformal transformation and then demanding that T in the W frame evaluated at W in the limit that W goes to 0 makes this thing vanish, will give you this. Okay.
Okay.
That was the basic bread and butter. So and the thing that was important here is that there was only a set of generators, which are the L0, L1, and L-1, are the only Virasoro generators that annihilate. Is that me? Oh, those guys. Hope it's not my stomach. So these annihilates are the only generators that annihilate both the in vacuum and the out vacuum, okay? And these are associated above with the global conformal transformation. Okay. The next thing that we saw that was very, kind of very important and very useful technique to study algebras and OPEs was to relate the contour integral of where R is some, so sometimes I put it, sometimes I'll drop it. In a way, everything that's written down, whenever you have a product of operators, they always should be readily ordered. So the latest guy should come first and the other ones should come later. So here what we studied is the contour integral of the OPE of some conserved current. With some operator, phi. And here we just did a contour integral where, okay, let me draw it like that. So we have the origin, we have Z, so we have W. And this CW is just a small little contour around the insertion of the operator, which is a W. And what we did is we related this to the variation of the operator under the associated symmetry transformation. Because if I have a conserved current, there is a conserved charge. Remember, the conserved charges are written by taking an equal time integral of the current. So it's something like Z, Z, Z. And we also know, on the other hand, that this guy is the equal time commutator of the associated conserved charge with the operator. I think W, okay? Where this guy is the equal time commutator, and it's defined by saying, in a way, that you take the limit of delta going to zero of Q of W plus delta times phi W. So that since this guy is later than this guy, it goes first. And the other way, where Q comes before. R, okay, is a symbol for readily ordering. OK, so let me say that I have R of Z1, Z2, of two things. Okay. It's like time ordering. It's exactly the same thing as time ordering, but where time is the radius of the plane, because that's our quantization surface. But essentially, okay, what using formulas, write it one last time. So I have this. So if Z1 comes later, you put it to the left, and that makes sense from quantum mechanics, because in quantum mechanics you have the vacuum state here, and you order things in time going to the left, right? So if you evolve for epsilon, you put an operator insertion here, epsilon. If you do two epsilon, so that's the idea. Okay. So this equal time commutator is defined by moving the first guy a bit later and then a bit earlier. And the way we could see this in terms of formulas was that this guy can be written as the contour integral. Oh, well, there is an origin here somewhere. So I have the origin, I have W. And the first integral, I do an integral. Remember that here I'm integrating z, right? So in the first term, what I'm integrating is z over a contour that is slightly bigger than the location of w. OK, this should be epsilon, but so this is the first term. And the second term, I integrate. And the origin should be at the center. And the second term is where you integrate just before W, because the location of phi becomes after the location of the current. And the difference of these two contours, or what's the same, the sum, and changing the arrow here, is exactly this thing. OK? So we related the commutator of a conserved charge with any operator to the residue of the product of the conserved current with the corresponding operator. And in order for this to be, and essentially what this tells us is that another interpretation also is that the transformation of the field under the conformal transformation is encoded into the singularities of the product of J with phi, because if you have singularities, they will contribute to this contour integral. So I'll have poles and have to use then the Cauchy theorem to pick up the poles. And that's how you relate things. So I gave you a few examples. Let me write it here. So the main example I gave you was that if phi is a primary, notice that this formula is true for anything. Phi may not be a primary. It could be a descendant. Yes?
In your top right corner, you have that's limits. Can you also call it was density
dropping? Yeah. Sorry? OK, maybe. Minus phi of W. So this is already the other. So now phi comes later than Q. So Q, by the way, at the contour, that is size delta before the location of W. So that's why in this picture, OK, so.
Right hand side. Yeah. Modulus of W plus epsilon, or it looks like an epsilon. It's a delta.
Oh, that's a delta. Yeah. OK, sorry. Yeah, this delta is the same as this delta. Same. Any other question? So I was saying that this formula is very important. It applies to anything, to primary, not primary. It's a consequence of the conformal word identities, and it's true for any operator in the CFC. But when phi is primary, it's nice, it's simple. So we will learn something, let's see. So we know that under conformal transformation, a primary has the piece that shifts, So you have epsilon d phi, right? You change the argument of epsilon, where epsilon, remember, is a holomorphic transformation, the conformal transformation, plus a piece that knows about the internal quantum number, which is h, times the derivative of epsilon times phi. Okay. So now using this formula, it tells us that the product, readily other product of Tz with phi w for a primary is, and here we use the Cauchy formula. This is now dw phi of w z minus w plus regular terms. We're here in order to derive this. All that we did is just use. So as I said earlier, I never put the 2 pi I because by this symbol I already mean the full thing, but let me just write it once so we are all on the same page. So dz, dz. So here is a contour where it surrounds set 0. This guy's operator. And here is n, where f is a holomorphic function. This formula is just the nth minus 1 derivative evaluated at the pole, of a pole at z0 over the n, divided by n minus 1 factorial. So you can, in your head soon, you'll be able to freely go between this picture and this picture, which is what I've done. So I just use the fact that if I plug this guy in here, and use the fact that I have a double pole and a triple pole, so I have a term with one derivative and a term with no derivative, you'll get exactly this other transformation. Okay, so that's if you wanted to compute the commutator of a conserved charge with any operator. Something that we're interested now in also doing is to calculate the algebra of conserved charges. So remember that associated to any symmetry in quantum mechanics, there's a unitary operator, and associated to that, there is a Hermitian operator, and those guys satisfy some commutation relation that tells you what is the symmetry structure, what is the algebra of those charges. So there we computed essentially Q with phi. Now it's essentially the same idea to compute the equal tie commutator of two conserved charges. All that I have to do now is think of phi there as another current, J2. And now what I have to do in order to get the charge, I just have to integrate the argument of the second current around the contour. Okay? So this guy is just, the first guy is what it was before, the integral of dz of J1z, J2w, which is exactly that formula, where now I think of phi, as the current Z2. But if I want to get the charge, all I have to do now is integrate this around the origin. Okay. So essentially, what this tells us is that we can get the symmetry algebra of any symmetry associated to a symmetry. So in particular, conformal transformation. So conformal transformations has a set of conserved currents. And what this tells us is that the symmetry algebra, as you do the symmetry, is completely equivalent to knowing the singular part of the product of the corresponding conserved current. Because if I know the singularity part here, I just pick up the poles. And that's how you get the commutator. So now what I want to do is essentially use this formula to derive the symmetry algebra associated to conformal transformations. And what are the operators that act in the Hilbert space associated with conformal transformations? And see what algebra they generate. Okay? Any questions about this so far? This should be a recap. Yes?
Phi as the current?
We think of phi as one current, like J2. Yeah, so here I plugged J2, and now integrate J2 over the W to get the charge. So if I do two steps, I think of phi equals J2 in that formula. And at the end of the day, I integrate over the location of, yes?
You said depends on being in two dimensions. I mean, the whole complex just requires you to be in two dimensions. But is this true more generally?
Yes.
Just it's a much harder
equation. This is just a consequence of the word identity. But in higher dimensions, we don't have the beauty of contour integrals. But the fact that the algebra of conserved currents is associated with singularities of the OPE of conserved currents in general. So here we just start with something very simple and universal, which is the word identity, and just we're extracting consequences. Yes?
So if I started with some symmetry, and I use that to calculate conserved charges.
Start with what?
With some symmetry group.
Yes.
And I use that to calculate some conserved charges. And then I plug those charges in this equation.
Yes.
And I get back the algebra of the group I started with.
Yes. Yes. More of the fact that sometimes you can have, and that's actually what happens in the case of Virasoro, you can have the fact that quantum mechanically the algebra is slightly deformed. So remember, for the Virasoro algebra, we had the algebra vector field, and we got the DeWitt algebra. Right? So. But now, when we do this analysis in the quantum theory, you can have a small modification of that, which is a central extension.
So
I'll come back to it. But essentially, morally, yes. The algebra of the conserved charges will be the same as the algebra of kind of naive global symmetries that you start with. Modulo this caveat I'm saying, no. OK, so now we have to study the Virasoro algebra, finally. And the way I'm going to motivate it is in the following way. We're going to use this kind of this master formula. And the first thing that we need to know is, what do we know about the stress tensor? We know that has h equals 2, right? It's an object that has dimension 2 and has spin 2. I hope people are now clear what I mean, but if not, you can ask. So now what I want to do is to write down the most general conformal transformation that I can come up with that a stress tensor can have, given that we know this data, that we know that it's a spin 2 object that has dimension 2. So the fact that the spin object has dimension 2, it tells us that delta epsilon of t, where epsilon is a holomorphic function of z. So there are two things. First, sometimes I write it. I think I write it like that. So the first term is just translational invariance, right? This is the usual term that we always get. You shift by the amount that you transform and times the derivative. Then we use the fact that it's a conformal. You know what? Let me rewrite. Sorry. I'll get tired of all the ways. Then the second term is just the statement that the stress tensor has a scaling dimension 2. Okay? Notice that we had a term like that here. It's exactly this term. But at this point, we do not know whether t is a primary or not. So what I have to write down is the most general thing that's consistent with the quantum numbers that appear here on the right-hand side. So it turns out there is one more term that I can write down. Notice that this guy here, t has dimension 2, right? So t prime has dimension 3. T has dimension 2, but here I have a derivative, so it has dimension 3. So I have to write down an object that has dimension 3 on the right-hand side. And let me normalize it. What you can have is something which is the third derivative of z. Notice that this term is inhomogeneous. It's not a term that is proportional to t. It has an inhomogeneous piece, which is a kind of the signature of the fact that the operator is not a primary. If operator is a primary, the variation of the field is homogeneous. It's proportional to phi and derivatives of phi. But here the variation is just proportional to some to the identity. Okay. When I write this, I mean that it's the identity operator there. And here I normalize C. So C is some parameter, which is the central charge. And now you can try to convince yourself that this is the most general thing you could write down, that's local, and that has dimension 3, as these two terms has. Okay. Of course, the choice of the coefficient is just a normalization, but I use it for, well, that's the conventional normalization. So this is the infinitesimal form. It turns out that you can also, and that's much harder, but it's also doable. I mean, you can always get far by doing many small steps. So you can, in principle, derive this, but I'm not going to do it. I'll just tell you what the answer is in case you come across this. So now you can think, this was a transformation under infinitesimal transformation. I want to integrate this transformation to a finite transformation. And so I want to know what happens if I map Z to W of Z. So then what happens is that the stress tensor maps to a new stress tensor. And it turns out that there is a piece, which is the naive piece that you would know how to write down by now. Which is this, right? This is the thing that you would have written down if I told you that this guy is an object, that a conformal field of dimension 2. It's a tensor. It has two indices. It transforms like a tensor with two indices. But the fact that you have this term tells you that, in fact, there is sometimes called anomalous piece or inhomogeneous piece. Another thing that is, not obvious, is that this can be written in terms of some object, this bracket, WZ, which has the property that when W is infinitesimal, I get precisely that. But for arbitrary W, this W of Z is called the Schwarzschild derivative. And it has a formula, crazy looking formula like this. So it's the third derivative of W divided by W prime minus 3/2 of W prime divided by W. Double prime divided by W prime square. Okay. And I'm not claiming that going from here to here is trivial. It's not. But I also don't want to take the detour to show this. But I think that it's important for us that I want to use here is that, and that's easy to show given this definition. I want to show that you can show. I'm not going to show. You're going to show that if you the Schwarzschild derivative of W with Z is zero if W is a global conformal transformation. Remember that the global conformal transformations, we could write them down as fractional linear transformations like this. Okay? And yeah, so that's the main thing that we want to use. So in particular, it means that if for the subset of transformations, which are these ones, which are the globally defined ones, this term vanishes. Okay? So that just means that T under those subset of globally defined transformations is really a tensor because you don't have this inhomogeneous piece. And that's the language I was using before. Notice that we defined the notion of primary and quasi-primary. The primaries were the ones that transform as a tensor for any conformal transformation, and we defined the notion of quasi-primary for those that defined as that transformed as a tensor only under these global ones. So that means that T of Z is a quasi-primary operator. Okay?
Where C was zero, then T would be a full primary operator. Is that right?
Yes, but the only theory that has C equals zero and is unitary is one that only has the identity operator. It's sad, it's a very sad I mean, in fact, okay, so that's a good point, though, but so I Googled C in exercises and other things. C is, but let me say this, but C is kind of an important label of the CFT. It's kind of, CFTs with different Cs are different theories, essentially. And we will learn how to compute this quantity in a specific theory. But I'll mention this in a second. So now what I want to do is the fact that we know the transformation of T under the conformal transformation. We know the finite one, but we're not going to really use it. And we know how to relate the variation of any field under conformal transformation in terms of a contour integral of the OPE, or the product of two operators. Just by using that formula upstairs, I hope it's clear that this is completely equivalent to writing the fact that the product of two stress tensors, of Tz and Tw, is C equals C over 2 times Z minus W to the 4th, plus, this is the term, that notice that if the field was a primary, if the field was a primary, this guy, the most singular part is a double pole. If you have an operator that's not a primary, you can have higher singularities. And the stress tensor is kind of a simple example of that, because it has the usual double pole that measures the dimension. But it also has a fourth order pole, which is a, kind of the signature to your eye that this guy is not a primary. And then we have this other term, dw, tw, z minus w, plus regular. And by now, it should be pretty easy for you to go from here to here. Essentially, all that I have to do is do the contour integral, right, of epsilon z times this. Now I have a fourth order pole, so using Cauchy's formula, I have to differentiate the argument that appears here. I have to take the third derivative, so that gives me this. This guy has a double pole, so when I use Cauchy's theorem, I have to take the first derivative, and that gives me that. And this guy has a simple pole, and I just get this. Okay? So we can freely translate between one picture and the other without any problem. Okay?
Fourth order pole is C over 2, not D and Z.
Sorry.
Thanks.
I don't know if this helps, but. Oh, my 2s and my Z's look similar.
In fact, it looked like a D was a bit.
Like a D. Okay. And again, this is the central charge. So now something immediately that we can conclude from this is that something interesting. We can characterize another way in which C appears in a conformal field theory. I mean, at the end of the day, one of the things that we're interested in is computing the correlation functions of operators. So now we can isolate which correlation function knows about Z, because now I can take the correlation function Z and W and use the fact that any operator that has, except the identity operator, has the property that the expectation value dot operator vanishes. Remember that I had this, we derived this rule that the expectation value of O is zero unless O is the identity. Oh, another way of thinking, here, of course, I have the identity. Okay? So that means that if I take the vacuum expectation value of this, this guy is zero. Well, everything here is zero. This is zero, but this guy is not zero. So I get C over 2, Z minus W to the 4. So if I want to calculate what is the central charge of my CFT, all I have to do is to compute the two-point function of the stress energy tensor at distant points and compute the residue of this fourth order pole. Okay? And so let me give you an example, which I still haven't decided whether we will do it in class or not, in exercises, of C, of calculating C. So The simplest case to do is, of course, for theories that have a Lagrangian description, where you can use propagators and stuff like that. Essentially, this kind of calculations you've already done in the field theory class in higher dimensions, but it's almost the same to do it in two dimensions. But if you take a free boson in two dimensions, a free scalar, so something that has a Lagrangian density, something like d mu phi. Okay, this phi and that phi is not the same, but the field. Then for this case, the central charge, you will calculate that it's 1. Yes? Oh, that's very good. Yeah, so these guys will have to do, I will come back to this later, but whenever you have the OPE of the stress tensor with something else, the singular part, the pole part, knows about the conformal transformations, and the regular part are the descendant operators. So these are the guys that, remember that we talked about these families, conformal families of operators, where we have the primary and descendants. So the operators that appear in the regular part are exactly all these guys, all the descendants. And we will see this more explicitly. But this, in a way, it's the easy part to get. This essentially is just doing Taylor series. This is classical mathematics. This is not quite classical mathematics because but this guy, in some sense, is quantum mechanical. But we will see more explicitly what kind of operators you get here. And these are the descendant operators. That's a good question, yeah. And the other example I want to tell is that of a free fermion. This, hopefully, we will study in detail because this is closely related to the critical behavior of the Ising model in two dimensions. And this guy has a central charge 1/2, okay? And in fact, if we have time, yes. Yes. Yes, yes, so let me give you a hint. So imagine the stress tensor. Can you guess what the stress tensor for a free scalar field would be? It has to be, it's fixed almost by dimensional analysis. It has to be dimension 2, and it has to be holomorphic. Okay, so let me write it and you'll see. Ah, okay. So it's something that's d phi, but this is the z derivative. But of course, whenever you study composite operators, even in free field theory, as Francois taught you, in order for this operator to make sense, you have two normal orders. Okay? So this is the normal order product of del phi with del phi. And now you can just use the fact that you know the propagator. You know that the propagator between phi of z and phi of w. So what does the propagator of a scalar field go like in two dimensions? Okay, let's do first in d dimensions. How does it go? A massless scalar field in d dimensions? We've done tutorials on this. 1/, okay, the difference to which power? And what is delta? Okay, very good. So now in two dimensions, this is 0. But what you have to think more carefully is that, in fact, you should think of this guy as a small exponent, and you get a logarithm. So now, just using Wick's theorem, you can calculate. So maybe we should put this in the tutorial. So maybe to calculate the OPE of TZ and TW using the fact that we know the propagator to extract C, essentially, okay? And show that C equals 1. I think you should be able to do this. It's essentially just free field contractions in a scalar field theory. Any more questions? Okay, so now I want to finally derive using this formula, the Virasoro algebra. I'll just sketch a few highlights, and then this is the content of the tutorial. Yeah.
Logarithm. You have to like introduce something in there to make it dimensional.
Yes, you have to use an infrared regulator. Another way of saying it is that actually phi is not a good conformal field, but the derivative of phi is a good conformal field. So when you look at actual good conformal fields, you don't have any of these funny regulators. So this is a kind of a reflection of the fact that phi is, strictly speaking, not a good conformal field.
Partly related to this under the homework, like in QFT2, when we did free normalization, we had some logarithm that was taken, some stuff that had dimensions. Then we just put a scale in by hand to make that less.
Yeah.
We could do the same thing here, that we put some scale in there to make it dimensionless. Isn't it kind of bad? Because this is conformal field theory. And we shouldn't.
But this is the common emitter. Phi is not a good field. So if you have to look at good operators in the CFT, you never have the problem. This is the fact that we're looking with a field which in some sense is highly singular. And in fact, it's not one of the operators that you calculate in correlation functions. It's not a primary operator. It's nothing. But, yeah. Any other questions? Well, something that looks, it need not be primary. It need not be primary, but it should have this. Where am I looking at? It should have this kind of pole structure, no funny logarithms and stuff. Okay, so now what I want to do is to sketch how you extract from our knowledge of the OPE. Of the two stress tensors, or the singular part of the OPE, which is all that you care in order to extract the algebra, because this only knows about the singularities in the product, so about the poles. So now, so I'll just sketch it, and you allows you to complete this. This is not hard, but it's I think it's a good exercise for you to become familiar with these contour integral manipulations and so on. It's really not hard. So what I want to compute now, so remember that I defined somewhere, write it again, that we can do a Lorentz expansion of the stress tensor. And now what I want to calculate is the algebra, the commutators satisfied by the Fourier modes of the stress tensor. So all that I have to do is essentially use this formula. Okay? So first of all, what is LM? If I want to isolate LM here, all that I have to do is multiply the left and the right by Z to the M plus 1. So that here I just have a simple pole. So the integral just gives me 1, essentially. And here I have a contour integral of Z to the M plus 1 times Z of Z. This is the kind of manipulation I want you to become familiar with. It's completely straightforward. I just essentially inverted this equation, okay, by using the Cauchy formula. So what I have here is just this integral of W, integral of Z around W. And now I have to put these powers, right? So I have Z to the M plus 1, W to the M plus 1, because I have LN and LM, times the OPE of the Z PW. Yes? So it's exactly this formula. Where now J, remember that J is just epsilon times T. For a conformal transformation, this is epsilon because I'm picking a particular Fourier mode times t. Okay. Now I use the fact that we know what the what the singular part of the product is, exactly that formula. So it's dw, dz, integrating like that. And now I just use the fact that the product has this anomalous piece, z minus w to the fourth, plus 2 t to the w, z minus w square, plus dw, dw, z minus w, plus a regular piece. And now what you can do to complete this, and this is the part that I'll leave you to do, it's completely straightforward, is now you use again the fact that t has a Laurent decomposition like this, and just do the contour integral. All you have to do is start picking up poles. Yes? Oh, yes, yes. So this was the comment I made at some point that for me, whenever I did, is e to the 2 pi I. This. All right, yeah. So all that I have to do is just to use the Laurent expansion of t in terms of L. And I just pick up the poles. It's completely straightforward. And now from here, you will show. Which is this is called the Virasoro algebra. Okay. So from this, the fact that we know the conformal transformation of T, we were able to derive the algebra of conserved currents associated with conformal transformations. And in a way, conformal field theory, to a large extent, is understanding the properties of the Virasoro algebra. What are the representations? It's like angular momentum. In order to understand the physics, whenever you have some rotational symmetry, it's very important to understand what are the different representations of angular momentum you can have. So here what we have to study are what the different representations of the Virasoro algebra. You'll see that it's very easy. If you see it in the right way, it's very easy to understand how to construct such representations. Any questions about this? This is kind of one of the highlights for a while. I mean, this is kind of a central object in this business. Okay. And the other thing that I want to tell you is that by using the same logic, yes.
Because that's what I have here. I
mean, right, that was... Oh, right, these are also... Well, these are not charges, though, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, these are
right.
Fully amount of charge. Okay, charge.
Okay. Yeah. Which is also a charge, yeah. Okay.
One question.
Okay. And now the other thing that you can do now is... let me just write it down. So from this formula now you can derive. So one of the things that we'll have to become familiar now is how to construct these conformal families, right? So here we started with some, and the way you start something always is that you start with a guy that has lowest energy. This is H, or the eigenvalue under L0. So we always start with the primary operator here. And these are the descendants. And one of the things that we have to understand is how to construct the descendants. And these are constructed in a similar way of how you construct different states in the representation of angular momentum by acting with the raising operator. And as we will see now, the raising operator is related to these LNs. So one of the things that we need to, that we can now derive very easily, from this equation, okay? If phi is a primary, okay, I won't, I'm gonna be lazy. Mm-hmm. Now what we can do is, this has the same information as saying that ln phi of w okay, so this guy is just the contour integral of dz second plus 1 dz phi of w. And now, using the fact that this guy is this, you get the commutator of ln with phi of w is just h times n plus 1 w n phi w plus w n plus 1, the derivative of phi w. Okay? So we can go from the OPE language to the commutator language, and both are useful, but they contain exactly the same information. Okay? So now let's think about, now that we have all this information, let's start thinking about how to construct the families of operators. And here you start always with phi, which is a primary of dimension, or with quantum numbers h and h bar. This is the guy that will sit at the bottom of the tower. And remember that h and h bar, we know from the what my discussion there, is obtained by acting on with the operator, the primary operator on the vacuum. Yes. Yeah, that's my. Everything should be n. Sorry, but my n and m are very. So the way we construct this is by acting with the primary phi at the origin acting on the vacuum. Okay, this was our definition of an instate. Okay. Now let's calculate what L naught, what is the L naught eigenvalue of this, using this picture. Okay. So I want to calculate what. Well, first I want to show that the state is an eigenstate of L naught. But now all I have to do is just follow your notes. Okay, I haven't done anything, right? And now you write this as the commutator. This is the kind of trick that you've played many times in usual quantum mechanics. You replace the product of two operators with a commutator plus the operator in the opposite order. Now I use the fact that the vacuum is annihilated by L naught. Remember, the vacuum is annihilated by all global transformations, by all LNs. In fact, that's one of the first things we derive. It's killed by all the positive frequency modes of LN, and in fact, more, also with the one that has zero and minus one mode. So this guy is zero. And now for here, I just use this formula. First of all, I'm evaluating at w equals zero. So if I put n equals zero, the w dependence here is trivial, right? I just get w to the zero, so it's one. And here I get w, but now I evaluate at w equals zero, so that vanishes. So all that I'm left is h times 0 plus 1, which is 1, times w to the 0, which is 1, times f phi of 0. So this tells us that this is nothing but h times phi 0, 0. I guess sometimes I put it together. Which is h times the original state. Okay, so we've shown that the state created by acting with the primary in the vacuum is an eigenstate of L0 with eigenvalue h.
And now, maybe this is an exercise, because I'm buying obviously behind, but using exactly line by line the same logic, you can show. You can show that ln acting on the state A6 bar equals 0 if n is bigger or equal than 1. That's the statement that ln with positive frequency is an annihilation operator for primaries. So any operator that you act on that state gives you 0. So this state cannot be lowered anymore by definition. It's the lowest energy state of the system. So by acting with ln, you cannot possibly lower the energy, so you just annihilate the state. It's exactly like in angular momentum when you look at the spin J. In angular momentum. The state with J and M equals minus J is annihilated. By J minus. Okay. And this just follows from exactly doing this and using the fact that we know that ln acting on the vacuum is annihilated acting for n bigger than minus. Okay. So H, this primary state is the lowest energy state of the system, of that representation. So that's why it's the guy that we put at the bottom of the tower. Now we want to create excitations. So in angular momentum, the way you create excitations out of the lowest azimuthal quantum number state is that you act with the raising operator that changes m by 1 unit. So the analog of that in this business is you act with the L minus n's. Okay? So L n's like to lower energy. L minus n's like to raise energy. Another way of saying it, maybe that's helpful, is that we have generators. We can split our generators as L0, Ln, Ln, and L minus n. This guy just measures the charge. See, this is the operator that we are diagonalizing. Okay, I make an analogy with angular momentum. So I don't know if this is useful, but maybe it is. So if it's useful to one person, that's sufficient. So this guy is like J3, just tells you the azimuthal quantum number of that state. Then we have the LNs, which are lowering operators. Which in angular momentum is played by J minus. And L minus N are the raising operators. Which in angular momentum is J plus. Okay? These are the guys that move you up the ladder. These are the guys that move you down the ladder and eventually kill you. Slide. And, a very simple way of saying that, just algebraically, that these guys are raising and these guys are lowering operators is that if you look at the commutator, the Virasoro algebra, this, you find that L0, Ln, is minus N, Ln. So that means that Ln reduces the eigenvalue of L0 by N units. So that's why we call it a lowering operator. And Ln, also acting on L minus N, increases the eigenvalue by n units. Okay? So of all this fancy Virasoro algebra, the thing that really matters and that's important in understanding how you construct the family is this commutation relation. That tells you what operators in the Virasoro algebra, if you split them like that, which ones raise the L0 eigenvalue and which ones lower them. Okay. So,
let's construct a few of the descendants. Now that we know all of this. Okay, yes. So let's construct the family of descendants. Yes. But y plus 1 is plus n, right? Yeah. I mean, the coefficient in the, on the right-hand side of the commutator is n, not 1. Okay, so how would you construct this? So we start with our primary state. Okay, now. And here I'll write the L naught eigenvalue. So the state, this state, we already calculated its energy. Its energy is H. And now all that we're really doing is either in this language or that language, whatever you prefer, we now start constructing higher energy states out of this lowest energy one. And the simplest jump that you can have is by 1. So if I want to create a state with the least amount of energy, by looking at this formula, I have to act with L minus 1. With that jump you precisely by 1. So you can create a descendant by saying and this guy has energy is plus 1. Now let's look at a state that has energy that you increase energy by 2. Well, how can you increase energy by 2? You can either act twice with L minus 1 because L minus 1 acts, shifts you by 1. So you act twice, it shifts you by twice. But now I have at my disposal also just using 1's L minus 2. OK, so maybe if you don't like this, if this is L minus 1 times L minus 1, or by acting L minus 2. So here I had one state with one unit of energy more than the lowest energy state. Now I have two states with 2 units of energy more. Let's try to do 3. So how can you get 3? You can get 3 by L minus 1 cubed, essentially. So this has H plus 3. Or you can do L minus 1, L minus 2. Or L minus 3. So here you have number of states. So this is the number of degenerate states. This is the number of states that have this eigenvalue. So here I have 1. Here I have 1. Here I have 2. Here I have 3. Can people see what the pattern is? Imagine now I want to look at states that have 4 units of energy more than the original one. So how would you construct this? Or let's say, clearly the logic is that you act with L minus N, which are the raising operators, in such a way that the sum of the modes of all your L's equals 4, right? Because L minus N increases you by N. So in fact, the general way to construct a basis of all states
0. So if I take L minus 1, L minus 2, is that the same state as taking L minus 2, L minus
1? No. Because the commutator of L minus 1 and L minus 2 is non-trivial.
So really we have another.
Ah, okay. State. So, yeah, so. But that state is not independent. So we'll see this now. Yeah. That's a good question, though. That's kind of where we're going. We want to construct a basis, right? So this is a set of states in which any crazy combination of LNs can be decomposed into those. And the claim is that the way you construct it is that you act. Okay, let me try to go. L minus K1, L minus K2, da da da. So this is the basis. If we take K1 to be smaller or equal than K2, smaller or equal than Kn. Okay? And this state obviously has L0 eigenvalue. Which is nothing but the sum from L equals 1 to N. Of K L plus H, right? I'm just summing the energy associated to its mode. Because L naught, if I act now with L naught, L naught will just go through and pick up every time the corresponding mode, KN. And now related to your question, the way to see that, for example, that L minus 2, L minus 1 is not a new state, let's see that explicitly. So what we need to show is that this guy can be written in terms of states that appear in this list, or more generally appear in this list. Notice that here I'm putting some restrictions, right? So I'm putting, I always order things such that a guy that appears on the left has the lowest mod, and then I keep increasing. So for example, so in this language, this guy would not be allowed there because 2 is bigger than 1, while the guy that appears on the left here is the smallest one. But now you can see just that this guy is the same as, I can write this like that, right? Plus, this is a famous trick. So this guy is the state that we already had, right? So this guy, I rewrote it in terms of a state that it is in the list, which is this one. But this guy now, I just used a bit of pseudo algebra, and this guy is just, I think it's minus L minus 3, acting on H. So now we're saying that this beast is the same as minus L minus 3, acting on H, H bar, plus L minus 1, L minus 2, acting on H, H bar. So what I've shown is that this state is exactly the same as a linear combination of states of this form. In this particular example, I just can write this guy as a linear combination of this guy and this guy. So it's not an independent state. So that's why I didn't put it there. It has no new information. Is that clear? Yeah. So now, do we want to get fancy or not? No, maybe not. Now you can try to count how many states with fixed, how many states with fixed descendant energy? So the question we can ask is how many independent with energy L naught equals H plus N, where n is some fixed positive integer, can we construct using that basis? Okay? And, well, so fairly intuitively, it's clear that what we're doing here, I hope it's, I mean, you have to play with it maybe to do one or a couple of more levels to convince yourself. But essentially, what we're doing here is counting partitions. Because I give you an integer n, 3, 4, 5, 17, and I ask you, in how many ways can I decompose n into a sum of integers? That's essentially the definition of a partition.
And one way you can try to formalize this, how to count. So now I want to count all the states that I can cook up by acting in all possible ways with these grazing operators. Another way of writing this is that another basis that I can use is that I can write any state like that in this way. So first, the smallest guy, which is L minus 1, then L minus 2, and then L minus, I mean, this goes forever, right? So, and the blackboard is finite, so I'll stop. Where L I is any non-negative integer. So I can act as many times as I want with L1, then I can act with any, oh, sorry, this is H. Well, it doesn't really matter, but yes. So we're speaking about acting on H. So I can act as many times as I want with L1, as many times as I want with L2, and so on. And now we do a little trick. Harmonic oscillator, which is all that we know how to do anyway. I want to construct an object which is sometimes called the partition function, which is you sum over all possible states. And notice, okay, that this guy would have an N. It will increase the energy of the primary state by an amount which is the sum over an index N, ln times n, right? So n because this is the energy of this mode, and ln because I have ln such operators. So what I want to construct is the sum over states of q. So I take the trace in the Hilbert space, this is a Hilbert space, right? So take the trace over the Hilbert space of Q to the L naught. Q is just some, at this point, is just a chemical potential for the L0 eigenvalue. That's the kind of thing you do in a statistical mechanics. You sum over some ensemble of states with some parameter that tells you what are the quantum numbers of your state. That's usually called a chemical potential or fugacity. And so that's the thing I want to sum. But this is the same as the sum. I can, by definition, essentially, is the sum from n goes from 0 to infinity of q to the n. So I have to sum over all integers because I'm summing over all states here. And now, what's the coefficient of this? Well, the coefficient of this is the number of states that have energy n, right? So this is the degeneracy of states in Hilbert space that have increase my energy by n units. So for example, for this example, D2 would be 2, right? I have two states with energy plus 2. I have 3 here. For 4, can someone tell me how many states I get that have energy 4? Yes. 5, okay, good. I was going to say that was a trick question, but yeah, so it grows. It's not as boring as yet. No. Next question. Well, this number is exactly the number. I don't think it's a Fermilab number, but this number explicitly is the number of partitions of n. Well, the question is, okay, maybe it agrees for the first three numbers. The question is whether it agrees later. But here we have a constructive way of computing the n, right? We have to essentially split n into sums of integers, right? So, I don't think it's a Fibonacci. Sorry? Good, yeah. Yeah, the next one is 7. Sorry. So now let me just show you how. So are people happy with this? I'm doing this a triviality. So I'm just summing a partition function over all states, all these states. There's an infinite number of them. And now I'm just organizing them in terms of subspaces that have a definite increase of energy by n. So I have energy increased by n. And all I have to do is how many states have energy n. And that's this number, which turns out to be the number of partitions of n. But so far, if we're not, we can just be inclined to ignore that. Yes? No. No. It's just numbers. I mean, this is. But it has connection with number theory, in fact. But I don't want to emphasize that point too much. But let me just take too much time to do this. But partially because it's fun. You should have some fun too. Okay, so these are all the states, right? Okay, I already wrote that. But okay, these are all the states that we're doing. So essentially, this sum can be written as a sum over all possible integers, right? All these LIs can go from 0 to infinity. So have the sum over all these Ls from 0 to infinity. All this, okay. Now, what is the energy of this state? Well, the energy of this state is the sum over little n of n ln, right? Because each oscillator with index n increases the energy by n, and I have ln of them, so each oscillator increases the energy by n ln, and I just have to sum over all different oscillators. But now I can write this. The exponential of the sum is the product of the exponentials, another deep formula. And I can write this now as the sum . Do we agree with this step? I didn't do anything here. We wrote this as a product. Yes. Sum over ln, sorry. I'm summing over all possible, the number of times I can act with that oscillator. But this guy here is just a geometric series, right? So this guy is just the product of n to infinity of 1 minus q to the n. Okay, so, and this guy, by definition, I computed the left-hand side, right? So this guy is nothing but the sum of n from 0 to infinity of q to the n, the number of states. So you can compute the number of states essentially by, if you want to compute up to number of partitions of 175, the way to do it is using this. Essentially, using this product formula. And notice that this number grows incredibly fast. So even though the numbers here for small numbers were very pathetically small, it actually grows exponentially. So if I tell you what is the number of partitions when n is very large, it grows exponentially with n, essentially. Okay? And this quantity is important, and we'll come back to it when we study the partition function on the torus of conformal field theories. This object is related to, it doesn't matter, to some, let's call it the Dedekind eta function, which is a function that we'll come back to later. Yes? Well, you have to pick up the power of, yes? Yes. But, I mean, you're saying if this is a practical way of doing it? Or this is a way in which you can do it, definitely. You can also do a contour integral, actually, and just isolate the n by doing some clever contour integral. should I? I would really love to finish this. I mean, can I take 10 minutes or no? Sorry?
Can we start tomorrow?
We can start tomorrow. Okay. Okay, more questions.
Yeah, that's the end of the lecture.
Very subtle. Yes.
If we add in lowering operators, do we get? Can we? It doesn't add any new states, right?
No. So, first of all, if you act with a lowering operator here, it kills you. But if you start from a lowering operator here, it will just move you up the ladder.
Okay.
Yes.
Here, when we did that geometric series, what kind of normalization are we assuming? Q?
Well, so that series, of course, is only converging when the magnitude Q is less than 1.
Yeah, is it?
Yes. Well, you will see later that we will be able to compute the partition function. So this Q will be related to something physical, which is we're going to compute the theory, not on the plane, but on the torus. And this Q will be related to the parameter of the torus. The torus has a certain complex parameter that tells you essentially the... And the conformal field theory depends on what's called the complex structure of the torus, which is the kind of... A torus, essentially, you can think of something in the plane, with identification, right? Yeah. And the torus is characterized by how you identify this side with this side and this side with this side. And we will be able to see that even though here we computed the theory for a value of the parameter being small, we can use conformal symmetry to evaluate that when the value of the parameter is large. Yes?
Can you use quaternions to make a 3 plus 1 dimensional CFT in the same way as this, using complex numbers?
No, wait.
Just because it's like we can use complex numbers because we're in these two dimensional space. It's quite nice. So you can, that would have worked any other number of dimensions. So maybe
but I don't know what you mean. So, quaternions? I mean, just to describe a theory in quaternions, you need 4 real numbers. It just happens that in 2 dimensions, you have 2 real numbers, x1 or x2, but I could just use complex coordinates. It's nothing more sophisticated than that. I mean, in 4 dimensions or in these dimensions, you need the real coordinates to describe it. Yeah. But I think it's probably wise that before we describe or try to think about that, it's probably better that we understand more pedestrian. But first of all, quaternions are not even conventional coordinates in the usual sense. As they said, they don't even commute. So, no, I mean, there is no... You can do non-commutative geometries and so on like that, but that's... Let's talk about that outside the class. Yes?
Calculated the number of states from one... You take one primary and calculated all the number of ascendants. That's right. So you could have lots of different primaries and you'd do the same thing. Does each one contribute to a partition function?
Yes. So now that we've constructed the family for a primary, so the way you should think about this is that now in order to specify your theory, and now the language that we will use is we will use this bracket language phi that contains all the operators associated to the family. So you're going to have phi, which is the lowest energy state in this picture, and then you'll have all the descendants. So these are the ones that you get just by acting with the raising operator. So for example, L minus 1, phi, and so on. And in order to characterize the conformal field theory, I have to tell you the spectrum of phi's. So how many primary operators there are. And what we will see is that there are theories in 2 dimensions that have a finite number of primaries. So you'll have a finite number of primary operators. Of course, each family is infinite because we just obtain it by acting with this lowering operator. And the, I mean, this theory plays an important role, which these are called the minimal models, which we will study because the simplest minimal models describe the critical behavior of two-dimensional statistical models, or actually the quantum behavior of d equals 1 quantum critical points. And these are particularly nice set of theories because we're dealing with a finite number of primaries. And then we can use the constraints of conformal invariance, which we'll discuss later, which is associativity, or what's called crossing symmetry in field theory, to completely compute all the correlators of these guys. And the reason we can do it is because we have a finite number of primaries, and we'll have enough equations to actually reduce the correlation functions of any number of primaries to a differential equation, which we can solve. But so tomorrow, what I didn't finish today that I wanted to finish today was essentially to tell you, so we decided at length how to compute the correlation functions of primaries and how they're determined. But I wanted to show you that the correlation functions of any of the descendants is uniquely determined in terms of that of the primaries. So you have a complete solution of the theory if you solve for the primaries, because for the descendants, it just follows algebraically. Essentially, you can write the correlation function of these guys in terms of the primaries by in terms of differential operator. But I guess I'll continue tomorrow.
I'm getting nailed on this, but I've been.